Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Okay, so we only have seconds. We're going to go right back into the interview or the discussion I had with Will Christensen, the chair, national chair of the Independent American Party. And so I'm just trying to expose you to other alternate conservative constitutional parties that we have out there, folks. And so I'm kind of tickled pink that we have another party, just like the Constitution Party, that kind of, I think we can work this out. We'll only have seconds on the back end, so we're going to go right back into this interview, and then I'll do a quick sum up, and we'll start talking about what we're going to be doing next in our next episode. Okay, so we're back, and we've got Will Christensen with us. We've been talking about the Independent American Party. We have gone through a few different rat holes, and when we were wrapping up in the last segment, what I wanted to really kind of get to is, what does it take to start unifying? Because if you look at the framers' recipe, each state kind of had its own party. They had their own cabal. Like I mentioned regarding the Anti-Federalist and the Federalist, there were people in each state that wanted to create this centralized power. But most of the power within the state, or I should say, those who were seated in either the legislature, the state house, or what have you, most of those folks were a part of the cabal of the state. This is why the Articles of Confederation completely failed, why they couldn't ever amend them. And this is why those men who went to Independence Hall to actually create this Constitution it was not a runaway convention. They were forced because they understood the cabal and the nature of the states refusing to give up their power to create a centralized government. And they drew upon that power, or that inalienable right that the Declaration calls out, the Declaration of Independence. It says, we have a right to alter or abolish our governments. And so they actually exercise that right of altering their government as necessary to create a centralized power that had enough necessary powers to do what it needed to do, and that was it. And I think they did an awesome job. I think the Lord did great work. But but what these men had to do, both in that and previously, leading up to the Revolution and leading up to the Constitution, this whole evolution, was how these people were constantly putting aside their differences, their self-interests, and they were actually unifying and working on what these things of common law, or I should not even, not just common law, natural law, and the God's law and nature's God, as they used to call it. But what they really focused on was creating a government that respected and protected individual liberty and individual sovereignty. And so, can we unite today, or are we going to die holding the flags of our parties? That's my question for you.
Well, that is an interesting question. Over the 30 years that I've been involved in this party, I have worked with, for instance, National Central Committee members of the Libertarian Party. We agreed to disagree on the items that we couldn't agree on, but we worked on the items that we did agree on. And I would like to see that type of agreement with any party out there. Now, I don't know that we have a lot of areas of agreement with the Green Party, the Socialist Workers Party, but the Constitution Party, the Libertarians, there are my goodness, there must be 100 different parties out there.
Right.
And we would like to have an agreement to let's not focus on what we disagree on. Let's focus on what we can agree on. And so.
So let me ask you this, and thank you for letting me interrupt you so many times. When you dealt with the Libertarian Party, did they agree on the Constitution, the organic Constitution, and the existing amendments? Could we all agree upon that, and that's what we live with, and that's where we go back to before we go moving forward in any other direction?
Well, you know, at that point, and this happened in the late 90s or early 2000s. we didn't go into it in that depth. We said, okay, now these foreign policy, taxation, etc., those we can agree on. But the moral issues, those we cannot agree on. And so we're not going to talk about those. We're going to talk about how we can affect change on the items that we do agree on. So we didn't go into it in that depth, and perhaps we should have.
Right. Well, so let me ask you this. Where are the moral issues within the Constitution?
Now, that's an interesting question. Life, liberty, and property are protected by the Constitution, and those are certainly moral issues.
Well, so life, liberty, and property is very specific in the Declaration of Independence, because that was a declaration. And yeah. In the Constitution, the federal government can make no law abridging your rights of all of these things of the Bill of Rights, because those were restrictions placed upon the federal government, not placed upon the states. And there was so that's when you really look at the articles of the Constitution from 1 to 7 and those bills of rights, it doesn't state anything that the federal government. It just says that the federal government can't create these laws or can't do these things, but it can't inject into your life. Whether you can do this, whether you have to take a vaccine, there's the only compulsion. This is interesting. The only compulsion that the federal government has is the Third Amendment, where they can actually require that you quarter their soldiers based on the law and the declaration of war. But they cannot demand that you quarter them without the function of law and the declaration of war. Does that make sense? So that's the only thing that they have for compulsion. And so this is one of the things that Alexis de Tocqueville pointed out in Democracy America, that the laws that were truly governing the morality of men were coming from their churches, that the government basically just created, okay, we're not going to, you know, create bills of attainder, ex post facto laws. We're not going to do these types of things so that we can play games and make you miserable and tax you to death. And so if you really look at the Constitution, it leaves it to the individual how they choose to morally live their life.
And that's true. Long as how they morally live their life does not infringe on the freedom or activities of someone else.
Correct. Your rights begin where mine end, and mine begin mine begins where yours end. So that's one of the things I learned from my father, who was a political science major. And so one of the things about Christianity, this is what I tell people, and it's pretty common, Republican or the conservative ranks, you'll find, you know, way leaders or, you know, priests and ministers or what have you. And when I came to a local area up here in Washington, a guy says, you know, I'm the minister at this, you know, Baptist church or whatever the church was. And he was like a district leader for the caucuses. And so he introduced himself, and I go, well, that's great, you know, because I truly, you know, see how liberty is a fundamental tenet of Christianity and the plan of salvation. And he looked at me and he said, well, I've never looked at it that way. And I go, sure. I mean, can you compel somebody to be saved? They have to choose for themselves, right? Well, yeah. And I go, okay, so liberty is that fundamental tenet. And at any point in time, once you've converted, can you sin and fall away? Well, yeah. And I go, okay, so see, liberty, we always have liberty. We'll always be able to make those choices, and hopefully we're making the right choices, but you can't compel people to not sin. You can give them consequences, and technically, God gave us consequences for our sins. Like, you know, if you have, you know, fornication or immoral, you know, sex and those types of things, there's sexually transmitted diseases. Well, as we look at government, and this is what I tell my listeners all the time, when you see government removing the consequences of sin, government has taken an evil position.
Absolutely.
And so we spend billions and billions of dollars trying to end AIDS and all of these sexually transmitted diseases, as well as abortion. All of these things are just consequences of strictly the immoral or the sexual immorality. Right? There's other immoralities out there, but on the sexual immorality, we spend billions, if not probably trillions of dollars since we've been in the business of doing evil or supporting evil. Probably in the trillions of dollars is what we have spent as a nation, and we should never have done that. Never have done that, because the government has no business dictating or trying to remove consequences of sin.
Agreed.
And so that's why, you know, there are consequences. They shouldn't be in the business of saying you can't do this or you have to do that either, right?
Yeah, we agree. Yes. We agree. Liberty and freedom are
integral.
Are basic to us.
Yes.
And as such, we then say, oh no, you don't have to support our candidate if you find a better candidate, or for any reason.
Right.
The spirit of party, we like to get rid of that.
Right.
And the spirit of party is inherent in almost every other party that I have run across.
And so one of the things that I realized that is the nature of politics is compromise. Well, there's no such thing as compromise when it comes to the Constitution, because the Constitution is the law of the land. Now, yeah. It's one thing to say the federal government has the ability to declare war. Now, there can be a compromise of a full-fledged war or just a naval action or, you know, a defensive action. So that would be where political compromise comes in. But when we start actually, and so let me focus on one thing in the Constitution. Clearly, the only entity that has the authority to enforce anything that is based or in pursuant to the Constitution, any law, the execution and enforcement of those laws must be done by the militia. Because Article 1, Section 8, because of the pause, I'll get to it. Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 15 says that Congress shall have the power to call forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, to suppress insurrections, and to repel invasions. So the states actually, and this goes back to the Whiskey Rebellion, the federal government just went to the states and said, okay, you know, have your guys collect this whiskey tax. Well, they didn't like it in Pennsylvania. They refused to do it. And so they rebelled against that. And so what they ended up having to do was there was a lot of violations of the Constitution, but let me just cut to the chase. They went in to enforce this by executing this with the militia. They arrested 24 people on the charges of treason, and two were convicted of treason for rebelling or protesting this libations tax or this whiskey tax. And so the federal government, is, if you read the ratification debates of Virginia, this is where they go into the details of why the militia was so integral within the Constitution and why the militia is even mentioned in the Bill of Rights. Because as you read the Second Amendment, it starts off with a militia being the, you know, the good security of any state. Because the militia was actually in the Virginia ratification debates, they laid it out that the militia is organized by county. Each county is supposed to have an apportionment, not, you know, some, you know, state apportionment. Because what happens if there's an insurrection in some far recessed county that doesn't have a lot of people and they don't have any representation in the National Guard? Well, that's what the militia is for. The National Guard was the excuse of not having to support a militia and actually make states more dependent on the federal government. But yeah. Anyway, but most people that understand the Constitution, and when the framers referred to a standing army, that the mischiefs and the dangers that come from a standing army had nothing to do with the military army. It had everything to do with the ability of the king to enforce his own laws and acts. So the reason that that was injected into the Constitution was to keep the federal government from being able to enforce their own laws. They were dependent on the people, which was the ultimate check upon power, that the people would have to put the tyranny upon themselves. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah,
I mean, what the Lord gave us and how they laid this. I mean, most of the framers didn't even realize what they had put into this, because they were just, the federal government didn't even exist. It wasn't even this monster. And what it was this noble thing that these men created. And for the most part, they tried to stick to it. There was some avarice. There was some nefarious players like Hamilton and so forth. But for the most part, it worked as advertised. But when the federal government started aggrandizing itself in the 1800s, and actually, this is the interesting part, because John Marshall made rulings, and there was like seven landmark cases where he made rulings, and in his opinions of his rulings, the rulings were sound. He was accurate on the ruling that the state cannot tax the federal government based on Maryland v. McCulloch. And so, but in his Maryland v. McCulloch, he made opinions that said, well, the federal government has the ability, because we're supreme, to be able to do anything and everything necessary because of our supremacy. So all of a sudden, you know, Madison, when he reads these opinions, he thinks this guy's an idiot, but he doesn't respond because rulings have no precedence. They have nothing. It's just a waste of paper. The opinions, the ruling is, as long as the ruling was correct, Madison wasn't going to say anything. And so for when Madison finally died, it was after he died when they started injecting precedents and case law and started building on those seven landmark cases, Maryland v. McCulloch, Marbury v. Madison, and so forth, where they started creating this monstrosity as Marshall interpreted in his opinions what the federal government could do. And so this is how they started breaking free and breaking these chains and starting with noble intent to do more for the states and more for the people. And as Washington warned us, based on the noble intent, that is how governments are destroyed. And so, but it took a long, long time, because what the Lord gave us was so good. Look at how long it's been to get it to this level of perversion, to where, you know, it's not even anything representing the government and the Constitution, but there's still this semblance of union amongst the states, that the states still have the time. They have the power, authority, and time right now. They can still save us. Does that make sense?
Certainly does, and that's one of the things that we work on.
Yeah, okay.
We're trying to... We see our educational efforts in with the state legislatures. I have tried for decades to influence Congress, the House and the Senate, one way or the other. Most of those efforts were very fruitless.
Right.
And so when we started this party, and we still, for the first decade or two, worked with Congress, but and we still work with Congress, but the effect that we have with the states is multiplied manyfold because the states are closer to the people. And I am in love with the American people. I mean, they are just tremendous. You look at what they do, and we are a fabulous nation because of our people. So we have been successful in educating. Now, when we send a bill out, we normally send the section of the Constitution that applies to this bill and gives it authority. And so we're teaching the Constitution to the to our state legislators, and we're sharing what is happening around the nation with those state legislators. And we've been quite effective in certain areas. Let me give you an example. Let's see. The Freedom for Religion Act. This was this bill allows prayer in public buildings and public places, which in effect nullifies the Supreme Court's decision on prayer.
Right.
Now, we sent that out a few years ago, and I got an email from a senator in Mississippi, and he said, well, we passed that 2 years ago. I said, well, I missed that. So I dug around and found out, and I called him.
Right.
And asked him to send me the bill that they had passed. And I said, if your bill's better than ours, we'll send it out. So that's, you know, the states are beginning to see that they have more power than they thought they had.
Oh, yeah, because, right. Sure.
Because the states are treated as the federal government as a stepchild.
Right.
And and they're not.
Right.
Their Constitution does not put them in that position, but the federal government, as presently constituted,
right,
would like to have them in that position.
Yeah, the word I use is the federal government's completely perverted the relationship. Now,
yeah,
what I believe is the most important thing right now that states must do is states must definitize the Constitution. They need to come right out and state exactly what Constitution and what is the supreme law that they will embrace and enforce. The reason I say this is because, as you know, the federal government has created this thing called the annotated Constitution, and they have all sorts of bureaucracies that are creating their own everything that they're doing, whether it be over healthcare, life, over environment, over education, over labor, over housing. All of these different things are what technically are the color of law. The federal government has never been delegated the authority over any of these things. None of these things. And even over commerce, the laws and regulations they're creating in commerce, that is all the color of law. They've never been delegated these authorities. And so what has to happen, because by living by the annotated Constitution, their court system is that's what they use. And so and that's what they use in their laws, and that's how they deal with everybody, is by, you know, so they've created what I call this artificial battlefield that doesn't exist. It is a house of cards, and they've got everybody to come and play on their battlefield. Mm-hmm. And what the states have to do is they have to take back the battlefield and say, we only recognize the organic Constitution and the ratified 27 amendments that have been ratified by the states as written, and that's it. And I'm really paraphrasing this down to try to be as brief as possible. But in so doing, then they basically kind of create this declaration that the federal government has enumerated powers that are specified and defined within the Constitution and its ratified amendments. If the federal government is exercising any role, responsibility, or power that is not within those enumerated powers and not pursuant to them, then they're violating our compact. And then this declaration would go out to these states. Because bottom line, if you look at what my work, it's all about what I call republic review, where it starts with one state, just like with Jefferson in 1798, where he audited the Alien and Sedition Acts and identified how each of these acts violated what parts of the Constitution. Well, so what has to happen in this first definitizing of the Constitution, that state and their legislature would then go and convene and conduct an audit, and they would call out every single power, role, or responsibility that is not enumerated or within the pursuance of those enumerated powers as unconstitutional, and then declare that out to the other states to say, we only recognize this Constitution, and these are all the roles, responsibilities, and powers that are in absolute violation of our Constitution. And then call upon them to join in doing and taking care of the necessary measures and actions in getting full compliance to our Constitution. And this would roll through the states as they start reviewing it. And if you look, I have a flow chart, and they start actually working together online. And once we have 27 states, once there are 27 states that, and the reason why 27 is important is because you have to have the full political control over both houses. Now, you may not have the absolute control over each of the individual people, politicians, but those states actually control enough of the House to demand that they fully comply to their oath of office, and or they will be subject to the consequences of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Then they would send directives and telling Congress, you will, you know, disband, and here's the schedule, because they'll provide them with a schedule of when to disband the Department of Education. And then, and that means everybody that is a part of that in any way, form, that's getting paid, curriculum, all stops, and they shut it down. But they do it over a grace period of like 6 months or a year to allow people to adjust, because having lost my job, it's not fun to have to all of a sudden be walked off, and you have no more pay and you don't know what to do. So it gives everybody a fair warning to say, you know what, even these people that have retired, they do not get their retirement anymore. They're going to have to be moved somehow into a private sector or something, but we can no longer pay for unconstitutional government. And so each of these powers would be handled in directives, Department of Transportation, the Department of Energy, the Department of Labor, and so forth and so on. And so then the states would, and this is how they interpose. Now, this is where it gets into this 27 states. There may be a Democrat in Texas that is a congressional, you know, representative. They may have Republicans, but they may have people that won't support the Constitution that are in Congress. Well, I don't care. If they do not vote in supporting the Constitution as directed by the state, who are the parties of the Constitution, then the Attorney General of that state would issue a charge of treason to have that person extradited based on Article 4 of the Constitution, and that person would be replaced by the governor with somebody that will actually support the Constitution, and then that person would go through their trial of treason or at least rebellion against the Constitution, and then they would be banned for life from ever being able to be a public servant in accordance with Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And this is how we move Congress to actually do the bidding that they're supposed to do in supporting the Constitution. All you need is 27 states.
Boy, I'm excited about what you're telling me. I think we're having a convention in November after the election.
Oh, okay.
And we'll bring this up, and I believe that this will be something that will be very exciting for our members.
I believe so too, and I believe this is exciting for the Constitution Party. I believe that there are people in the Libertarian Party, and I can tell you that the entire Wyoming Republican Party is supporting this because they created a resolution in 2019 that actually called for a full audit of the federal government and then to basically, you know, disseminate this out to the states. In essence, they're calling for republic review. They already have a committee in the Republican Party in Wyoming that actually is a republic review state committee. And, you know, getting representation, and we've been growing there. It's been kind of hard with the pandemic and so forth, but bottom line is, I believe anybody that loves the Constitution will easily see that this is not about a party. This is about unifying on the Constitution. And this is where I'm kind of walking down this path of getting, you know, people. As what my initial intent, and I just want to be honest so that you, you understand where I'm coming from. I reached out to the Constitution Party because I wanted them, because just by the name, the Constitution, then it should stand for exactly what it does. But it doesn't today. There is a long road to hoe for the Constitution Party to get where they need to be, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
That makes sense, and that agrees with my experience with them.
Yeah, well, I feel I have that same the distance to travel with the IAP, because the bylaws have to change. Bylaws need to be very clear and succinct that no person that is wearing this party label can actually violate their oath of office. They will be removed, and we will use all power to remove you from that seat. Because if it's all about supporting the oath, supporting the Constitution, then the political agendas go away. It's not about, you know, having to promote abortion or decide. Abortion isn't a problem anymore because it's a violation of the Constitution, and it is stopped. Just like education is stopped. Obamacare is stopped. All of these things are stopped because there are no enumerated powers delegating those powers to be able to function by the federal government. And this actually forces the states to actually disband all of these offices and interconnections with the federal government on the environment, on education, all of these things. And in my opinion, each of the states need to rewrite their constitutions, empowering the counties to actually where most of the power sits, that the states become the administrative center of making sure that the funding is adequate and proportioned and fair, so that, you know, all the different counties have the appropriate technologies or what have you for education, for whatever the people want to empower that state in, you know, their constitution. And so anyway, because if we understand that our constitutions, in the essence, this is the thing I learned about the ratification debates, is that our constitution is an enumerated constitution. It is the only one in the world that's enumerated. All the British, the Roman, all other constitutions provide general powers. So the states actually have general powers in some of their constitutions. Some of it's enumerated. This is why I say they have to clean up and remove all of these general powers and all of these mandates from the federal government that are all unconstitutional, and trim it all down to really what powers do they want the state government to have. And that's it. And then the rest of those powers need to go out to the counties, because if you live in Massachusetts, the counties that live or that are right there on the water shoreline, they have more money and they have all the influence over that government. But does that mean that the agricultural counties are less important for representation? No, it's the same thing with states and the Senate. There's the apportionment for the people and the responsibilities between, and this, again, this is the divine hand of providence showing his brilliance in creating this duality of sovereignty from the sovereignty of the people to the sovereignty of the sub-element of government. And that's why at the state level, all states created bicameral legislative bodies where they had a Senate and representatives of the people. We're not living by the American republicanism where we are recognizing the sovereignties of the counties within the states. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And we'll discuss these, and I would like to have your assist on this.
Oh, I'd be happy to. I absolutely would love to help if I can help unify everybody. One of the things that I can't emphasize enough, people do not realize the evil of the Republican Party. The Republican Party is not the Madison's Republican Party. It is a big government, and it is a colluded party to where we really have a uniparty. The Democrat and Republican Party are working together at the national level. And it doesn't matter what direction they go. It's all about how one side will, control this lever and that lever versus the other side. And so we have to actually, because all of those levers are made by compromises that violate the Constitution. We have to remove all those levers, all those compromises, all those violations, and then let them actually steer the ship based on the powers that they actually have instead of making it up as they go along. Because it's been a lot like a child that has slowly perverted his relationship with his parents to where he now has subjugated and has enslaved his parents as the states. And it's the same thing with the counties. But this is where I believe unification. And so the real question and the reason why I wanted to talk to you, the national chair, is what are the odds of the Independent American Party being able to separate itself? Because I don't want people to separate themselves from their religion, their moral positions, and their ideologies. What I want is people to unify on the Constitution, because I see the Constitution as something that people in India can embrace because they believe in, believe it or not, that culturally they have a caste system, culturally they have all these divisions, but as a people and ideologically and philosophically, they have the ability to respect and actually embrace individual liberty and individual sovereignty. And there's other faiths as well, Confucianism and so forth, that, can actually embrace these concepts. But as we talked before, Mohammedans can't. And I don't believe that our Creator wanted liberty to be limited to that land that's in between the Pacific and Atlantic and the latitudes that make up the continental United States. I believe that our Creator wanted all people to have the liberty to be able to choose to follow Him and have that opportunity.
Well, that's my understanding too. And can we neglect the spirit of party and the in the Independent American Party? Yes, I believe we can, because we talk about that from time to time, and when we see it rear its ugly head, we do what we can to get rid of that.
Good. That's awesome, because it seems like as I've had this conversation, I can't get the chairs of the Constitution Party. So some of them are just afraid to, because there's these factions within the Constitution Party that are the problems. And so anyway, I can't get them to actually, take that stand, to drive that, what I'll call that flag at the top of the mountain to say, yes, we can unify on this, on the Constitution. And so... what whatever it takes, because that's what we have to do. And I figure that's my mission, is not to create a party. It's to unify, because we no longer have time to create an organization. We have to unify, and we have to unify quickly, because we're losing time. And I believe the good Lord is still being patient with us, but we have to unify.
Yeah, he is. And I've been in this battle for many, many years, and I believe that our Father has given us the opportunities to set some things right within our government, because the American people are, if I could use a religious word, they're repenting. And they're repenting of many things, not in a religious point of view, but in a moral and even in some areas a political point of view.
Right. Yep.
So yes, that's we'd like to be involved.
Well, I tell you what I tell my listeners. This is what I tell my listeners all the time, because I constantly have to point out that only our Creator, only He knew what we would be dealing with in these days. And He gave us everything we need in that Constitution. And this is why I tell people that the 14th Amendment, because anybody that understands the biblical history and so forth, there is sanctification comes by the spilling of blood or through the work and service of an individual. That's how you sanctify something. You sanctify it by your, you know, sacrifice, work, those types of things. And so we had to sanctify this nation twice. The first one was in the Revolutionary War, breaking away from England. And the second one was the Civil War, in breaking away from enslavement, where all men could finally be free. And so in so doing, the Lord was definitely involved in that 14th Amendment. That's why when I look at all four sections have relevance today regarding citizenship, regarding the sovereign citizen movement, regarding Section 4, that no debt could have been incurred. And so what they ended up doing by creating the corporations to pay Britain over the war debts was absolutely a violation of Section 4 of the 14th Amendment. And so as I look at the 14th Amendment, it is almost equal in divine inspiration as, you know, the Bill of Rights and the Constitution itself.
Interesting.
If you read Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, this is where it removes anybody who fails to support the Constitution. In other words, they've taken an oath and they've committed moral perjury by faith. So what is supporting? This is where I get down with politicians and we go into the nuts and bolts of this. What is supporting? Is supporting just a wall, or is supporting like an immune system? And I believe that a politician is like the immune system. Politicians are like the immune system. They're supposed to attack any rebellion, anything foreign that doesn't belong, that they're not to take a passive role in sitting on their hands. In so doing, they're committing what they call a sin of omission by not supporting. They have to have an active role because they are our representatives, and they have to actually be actively supporting that Constitution. So when you read Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, you'll actually see that that's the final teeth that we needed to be able to hold our public servants fully accountable. Because at the time that the framers were creating this document, that was when duels were a part of life. If you impugn somebody's character, they could, you know, defend that through a duel. I mean, honor meant more to men back then than life itself. But that got lost as we migrated towards the Civil War. And so that particular section, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, gave the teeth in forcing compliance, or forcing that moral code, as Senator Howard of Michigan stated during the congressional debates. He says, I see it that if somebody takes an oath to support the Constitution and they don't support it, then they're committing moral perjury. So anyway.
Can't argue with that.
So, anyway, this is how I, you know, when you put it all together, I know there's lots of people that have problems with the 14th Amendment, but that's only because the way history has framed that. I believe the great deceiver has deceived us all regarding that amendment. And so now we can actually see, and when people start looking at it, and they start looking at the history, they start seeing the divinity. You know, the Constitution possesses the DNA, I believe, of our Creator, that we are to refrain from compelling, from controlling. And when we look at our government now that is doing nothing but compelling and controlling and, you know, demanding, are you kidding me? Anyway, I don't want to take up much more of your time, but what I'd like to do is I'd like to actually let you sink your teeth into some of the stuff I've written and what we've talked about, because I truly believe that the alternate parties can, and simply, if they united, could actually send a stronger message to that Republican Party, where people feel like they're already upset. They feel disenfranchised. And we're losing time because, you know, when people are upset, you want to capture that emotion so that you can pull them in, and people become hardened or apathetic or what have you. And that happens over a little period of time, and we're kind of losing that. But I believe Biden and what he's doing is helping the marketing and getting people to recognize what we have to do, and is kind of keeping that anger and that angst of people boiling. So let's seize the day, carpe diem, right? Let's seize the day and the opportunity to unite. And so I really, it's great to hear that the Independent American Party is out there putting the Constitution over the party and the party interest, which is great, because that's what we need if we're going to heal this country.
Well, that has been our plan for the, 30 years, excuse me, that we've been working. And we support, well, for instance, most of our executive committee and most of our members supported President Trump on his second bid. On his first bid, we were not sure, but when we saw what he did as president and what he attempted to do, then most of our members became supporters and promoters of President Trump.
And I'm still reserving my position on him because he still hasn't done enough, and he's yet to really put constitutional under standards. There are people that have Constitution somewhere in their title or in their resume, but they do not understand the Constitution, and they've actually got him to continue with some of the big government, some of the, you know, like the USMCA and those types of things. And so anyway, what I'd like to do, Mr. Christensen, is I'd like to give you a parting comments, and, you know, where people can go, what to do, take as much time as you need. But what I'd like to do, though, is get your acquiescence or agreement that we can kind of meet again to talk a little bit more about how what I'm doing, I think, actually dovetails with the IAP, as well as the Constitution Party, as well as all these other parties. But if you can find some time in the near future, we can do that, and that would be great.
All right. Well, I am very interested in what you're doing, and you have given me some new thoughts, and I'm always agreeable to those. So if any of your listeners are interested in the Independent American Party, we have a website. You can go to usiap.org. usiap.org. O-R-G.
Uh-huh.
And take a look at that, and you can see some of the a list of bills that we've supported over the years. You can look at our 15 points for good government. Some folks in Texas took a look at our platform and came on en masse. And so we are open to those who support individual liberty and freedom, and we have an organization in the states that is made up of contact people who are listed on our website, and so that if someone has runs across our party and wants to know about it, then that contact person can answer questions along the lines of the party, and if they get stumped, then they pass it on to a state level or national level. So, and also we have congressional district representatives, and sometimes as many as half a dozen in some states. And these are representatives who whose job it is to organize the party and act as the coordinators for their congressional district. And when we have enough coordinators and contact persons in an area, then we organize on a county basis. And then when we have enough counties organized, we organize on a state basis. And that organization is follows the county or state chairman, vice chairman, secretary, treasurer. These are the elected offices. And then we can work together. We send out to our members emails from time to time, and asking them to do certain things and support certain items. So we are looking for liberty fighters and freedom fighters. And those, if you're one of those, there's a place for you in our party.
Okay. So, all right, great.
Thank you, GR.
No problem. And there are a few things that I will ask in the next, some more administrative types, you know, like members and that type of thing. But we ran out of time again. Thank you again for your time. And folks, we will have Will Christensen back on, and we will talk more about the Independent American Party. And I'll give you more, folks, I'll give you the statuses as we move forward. But thank you again for your time. And with that, folks, we're going into a break real quick, and we'll be right back after this. All right, so we just got seconds left. We're going to basically be back on in our next episode with a little bit more content and some more marketing. But what I'd like to do is I'd actually like to hopefully have, by that next episode, have a follow-up with Will to basically see where we're at, maybe having him back and getting a little more exposure on the Independent American Party. This is G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.